Good afternoon. You are joining Bill trying to get into his chair.
Oh, no, I'm in my chair.
You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Morton.
Bob is where all the good music comes from, just so you know. Okay, so we've had a busy week, lots going on, and I hope you were able to listen to the archive of last week's show, because it was really good. And just a little FYI, we do have Claire Lopez on for 2 hours, just all by herself, so we won't have the Bruce and Claire over-talking, although it is kind of fun. But Claire will be on, it drives Bill crazy. I think it's on December 10th. I'm pretty sure. I'm putting it on the website for you, but something to look forward to. When we all get distracted by Thanksgiving and Christmas and all that jazz.
Now, will Claire be driving or will she actually be stationary?
I'm thinking Claire will be in one place because we set that up. We planned way ahead. December 10th is way ahead for us. All right. So this morning, we're going to start off with Robert Ault, who is the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute. I do hope you go on and read his bio because it's awesome and extensive.
For you Ohio State football fans.
There you go. And
got those Buckeyes?
Maybe I'll have him tell what the Buckeye Institute does, but I thought I'd give a couple little blurbs here. Because, I don't know, it's kind of weird to talk about yourself, so I'm not going to ask him to talk about himself yet. So he is a nationally recognized scholar with expertise in legal policy, including criminal justice, national security, and constitutional law. Prior to heading the Buckeye Institute, he was the director in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, serving under former U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese III at the Heritage Foundation, where he regularly advises members of Congress and Supreme Court litigants on complex legal arguments and strategy. So he's not just going to be making stuff up, bottom line. And we're talking about workers' voting rights today, which is kind of an interesting topic for us, and he has a very interesting take on it as well. So, Mr. Ault, are you in there, and can you hear us?
I am here and can hear you, and I'm glad to be on the show today. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on. The more we read, the more we wanted to know, and then we just thought, okay, he's going to have to come on and give us the 411 here.
Absolutely. So to answer the question, I heard we are not associated with the university, but we are fans of the Buckeye football team.
There you go.
State law here in Ohio. you get a Woody hat when you cross the state line. So,
it's a rule. If you're going to live there, you've got to be a fan. No?
Oh yeah. You do that, and you have to have some sort of a skeptical eye toward Michigan. It's all part of the pack.
So it's probably easier if you come there as a child. You just get indoctrinated as a child. You know nothing different. So,
yeah, but the Buckeye Institute, we're a free market think tank and do work on legal and economic policy. And recently we've been taking a look at worker voting rights, in part because as we did some research, we came across what I think is a pretty startling statistic, which is that 94% of union workers in America have never had the opportunity to vote for their union representation. And this is largely a function of the fact that the elections to put the unions in place to represent bargaining units are functionally something like one and done elections. Once they're elected, there's no need or even opportunity to ever have a vote again. And so to give one example, just to sort of paint a picture, here in Columbus, Ohio, where I live, the local teachers union is the Columbus Teachers Association. That union was voted in as the bargaining representative back in the late 60s when Richard Nixon was still in the White House and the Beatles were still together.
Wow. They should have a pretty good handle on how it all works then, I guess, huh?
Well,
presumably.
But think about it from the perspective of a teacher. You walk into the average elementary school in my neighborhood, the teacher who's up in front of that classroom very likely wasn't even born in the late 60s. So they've never actually had the opportunity to vote for whether or not they want this union to be representing them, whether they'd like another union to be representing them, or whether they'd like no union at all. That's never a question or an opportunity that they've had, and yet they're required to pay union dues or agency fees to that union to represent them.
Now, were these folks originally voted in, or were they just appointed, or how'd that work?
Generally speaking, the mechanism is they are voted in by the workers in the bargaining unit, but at this point, you know, you've got many. The example I gave isn't even the most egregious in many of these examples. It would have been someone in your grandparents' or great-grandparents' generation, perhaps, who voted in that union. And you've never actually had a vote. You come and take the job. The union's already there. And if you happen to be in a state like California or like Ohio that's not right to work, a condition of your employment is paying your union dues or your agency fees if it's a unionized workplace. And which is to say, if you don't do it, the employer is required to fire you. And yet you never have had the opportunity to actually have a vote for that particular union. It denies these workers a voice. It denies them any kind of a choice. And there could be choice with regard to the unions representing them. And I think it's fundamentally unfair.
Well, you know, I've never been in a union, and I apparently don't study them much, but I didn't even realize there could be a different union. I mean, it just seems like every, you know, these guys are such and such local number, whatever, and I never thought about where they came from. You know, there were other choices. So a teacher's union could, I mean, teachers could have, where do you find a different union? Are they just?
Oh, sure. There are a couple of different big national unions. The National Education Association, which has, for instance, in Ohio, the Ohio Education Association. You also have the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, which has local affiliates. But sometimes, even within workplaces, you could have different unions representing different individuals in the workforce. So, for instance, here in Ohio, we actually published a blog a while back by someone who was working for us, and his mother had been a school bus driver in Ohio, and the school bus drivers were represented by the Education Association, by the teachers union, and they weren't doing a very good job. And they were actually able, it's quite onerous to switch unions if you don't have worker voting rights, but they were actually able to switch and get the Teamsters to come in and be their union. They were much happier with the Teamsters representing them. So that's just one example, but there are a couple of different teachers unions that operate. And again, if there actually were the opportunity for there to be greater competition, I'm guessing that there would be more unions pop up. And in fact, in some states that have done labor reform, you've seen small independent unions that have cropped up to be able to address the specific needs of the workers. And that's really what we're talking about in this, is making the unions more responsive and giving the workers a voice and a choice. Right now, 85% of union workers who we've polled think that having regular periodic elections for their unions, their union representation, would make those unions more accountable to them. And that tends to be one of the biggest complaints we hear, which is, look, we pay these union dues, but it really doesn't matter what level of service they provide. If they provide good service, bad service, or no service at all, they're still going to get the dues. We don't have a vote, a real opportunity to vote them out. And so because of that, there's just not an incentive. There's not the competition that you would have if there was the possibility of replacing them with a different union in order to actually hold them accountable.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I guess I always thought if you were a teacher, you were in the teachers union. I didn't realize there were a whole bunch of little options. But I think if people did have options, maybe the unions would work better. I speak with people all the time who are having some sort of issue at the workplace. And at the end of the day, I have asked quite a few of them, well, don't you have a union? Oh, yeah, but they basically side with, you know, whatever the management, I guess, is the best way of putting it. They seem to be wholly owned by the management. And so if the management wants to do whatever they want to do, the union kind of backs them, which makes it even more stupid to be in a union, I guess, from my perspective.
Well, if you go to our, if you go to our website, workervotingrights.org, we've got quotes, one from a very prominent public sector union head who admitted in a state in which they enacted worker voting rights, they admitted that before worker voting rights were in place, that they had taken their workers for granted, that they weren't even communicating with them well, which, again, just goes to this question of if you're not subject to competition, if you aren't subject to regular elections, there's just not that incentive to provide the higher quality of service. And we've all seen this in the private sector.
Sure.
I mean, for those of you who aren't union members, I mean, I remember the bad old days of cable companies. I don't know if you all do. Back when, you know, there was one cable company that provided service to your neighborhood.
Sure.
And you called for an installation, they'd give you a time frame sometime between noon today and 5 p.m. next Thursday.
Yeah.
But competition came in. All of a sudden, you're getting shorter time windows. They'll text you when they're on the way. The prices are going down. The quality is going up. Competition is good. It, you know, oftentimes, those who businesses fight competition, but when it comes in, it makes everyone better. And there's no reason to believe that that wouldn't be the case with regard to unions. And certainly, if you look at union members, how they feel about it, they certainly feel like having that kind of voice and choice would create better opportunities and better accountability.
Sure, because they're the ones footing the bill, and you know, if they're not getting the service, then they're the ones being hurt by it. We've got to take a really quick break, and then we will come back with our guest, Robert Ault. We are speaking about workers' voting rights today from a perspective I think most of us either haven't thought of, and if you're out there in a union, kind of hoping Robert's got some ideas for you here by the end. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Third boxcar, midnight train, destination Bangor, Maine. Oh, worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues. I smoke old stogies.
Old classic.
Nice. So Robert, we were chatting on the break here in the background and wondering, how do you, if you're in a union, if you're in a place that has a union, but your management oftentimes, at least here
State of California.
In California, if your management, you don't have to be in the union, but they still take the dues out of your check?
Well,
is that pretty common?
Again, if you are, if for instance, you're in a situation, there are some positions that are, you know, I'd have to take a look at how it's structured in California. But there are some positions that you would traditionally think of that might, you know, look like, you know, white collar or management positions that are still unionized. And again, so long as it is organized, at that point, you're required to either, you have two choices. You can become a member of the union, you pay the full union dues, and that includes, you know, that will include some portions of participation that aren't, go beyond collective bargaining. You're not legally required to pay that. Or you cannot be a member of the union, and you still have to pay what are called agency fees. Those are the fees for the collective bargaining services that are provided. But oftentimes, what's included in that ends up being things like, for instance, they include, I think, some of their educational activities and the like. And, you know, there's always some level of scrutiny and skepticism as to how much is included in the agency fees that aren't really core collective bargaining, aren't what you or I might think of collective bargaining, but end up being much more, you know, sort of activities related to, if not explicitly involved in, political activity. You know, so we've all seen that if you've got friends who are members or pay agency fees to the teachers unions, we've all seen the glossy mailers that they get, you know, oftentimes their magazines talking about what it is that they're doing for them, and it ends up having, you know, picture after picture of the individuals in the union standing next to candidates at events and the like, and it, you know, it ends up looking like a soft promotion for those candidates. And this ends up being, again, one of the things that frustrates union members, which is to say, obviously their money is going to do that. And, you know, is this something that they, are these candidates whom they really support? In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. But oftentimes the unions overwhelmingly support one party or another. Nationwide, it tends to be the Democratic Party. They tend to support, you know, if you look at donations, generally speaking, 90%+ of them go toward the Democratic Party. Here in Ohio, interestingly enough, the unions end up giving very heavily to Republicans, at least in the in-state election. So, but whichever way it goes, it, you know, it's one of those things, whether or not that actually reflects how it is the union workers would like their money to be spent is a serious question. And there's very little recourse for the members as to how that's spent in the absence of being able to have something like worker voting rights where they could hold their unions accountable.
Right. And that's I had a relative that worked for the state of California and had to pay union dues, was not a union member, and the only explanation she was given was that she did benefit from the bargaining, I guess the collective bargaining. So what you're saying is probably true for the state of California as well. And, you know, she wasn't happy about it. She didn't really feel that, you know, she was part of the union. Why should she have to pay dues?
Yeah, and this is actually, if you take a look, there was a big lawsuit, went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court a while back. That was brought by a California teacher, Rebecca Friedrichs, and she objected. She chose not to be a member of the union, but she still had to pay those fees, which end up being, in most cases, most of the union dues. I mean, it ends up being, you know, something like 80% to 85% of what the cost of the union dues would have been. And she looked at how it is that her monies were spent, and she saw teachers who were abusing kids and so forth being defended by the union. She saw the unions, you know, objecting to merit as a form of consideration for whether it was compensation or if there had to be layoffs. The unions would fight very hard to prevent teacher merit from entering into the considerations. And she said, look, this isn't what I believe. I don't think I should be forced to speak in this way with regard to collective bargaining. And so she brought a First Amendment challenge, took it all the way up to the Supreme Court, had oral arguments, and it looked very much like she was going to win her case. And then Justice Scalia passed away. And so the decision ended up deadlocking 4-4, so, which means there was no decision issued by the Supreme Court. But because of that, there's another case that the Supreme Court has decided to take up just this term. And so they recently accepted the case for hearing, probably going to be heard early next year. And it raises fundamentally the same questions. Can you force a public sector worker to engage in collective bargaining speech? Now with Gorsuch on the court, you know, it's always difficult to figure out how these things will go, but I think that the case has a decent shot. The fact that the court decided to, you know, the Supreme Court largely gets to pick and choose which cases it wants to hear. It hears less than 1% of the cases that it's asked to hear. So the fact that they chose to take this up again so quickly after the last case really does suggest that this is a question that the court considers to be very important and one that it wants to weigh in on.
Well, there's a huge difference between the public's, you know, the public employee unions and the, you know, the
private sector.
The private sector stuff, the plumbers and the electricians and all that sort of thing. And just, you know, from what I hear, people are pretty frustrated with the public employee unions. They just they feel like it.
Well, yeah. If you're a public employee, should you have the right to walk out? I mean, they tend to have a lot more power than they should. I mean,
it also seems to protect the bad guys. We don't seem to be able to get good people in those jobs because obviously it's longevity and seniority, that sort of thing.
Well, that too.
But they wind up protected and unable to be fired, and the VA is the one that springs to mind, actually.
Well, I just look at, like, city workers. You know,
There's that, too.
The garbage collectors decide they aren't getting enough money, so they go on strike, and all of a sudden the city piles up with garbage. That's a pretty strong bargaining tool to give them what they want. And so they tend to have kind of power over the public in some instances. Do you find that to be the case in most cities?
In some cases, that ends up being a tool to choose. Now, notably, in some areas of service where, for instance, you've got unionized public sector workers, such as safety.
Safety's a biggie, yeah.
Those involved in safety, generally speaking, there'll be clauses that will prohibit them from striking. So, or at least that's the case in a number of jurisdictions. So you couldn't have the police force
go
out
on
strike, for instance.
Well, I was kind of thinking about just the basic bureaucrats out there that are processing things for people. And, you know, we've heard scandal after scandal after scandal with VA. And when you dig down into it, a lot of it is they're protected by their union.
Well, you've got some of that. You also have, keep in mind, I think one of the things that ends up frustrating a lot of folks, and I think it frustrates a lot of the workers as well because it paints them with a bad brush, which is just you've got this sort of strange system with public sector employee unions and politicians wherein you've got unions which end up making very large campaign contributions to politicians and to political parties, which help to get individuals elected. Then, when it comes time for those same public employee unions to negotiate contracts, compensation, et cetera, pensions from those politicians.
From those same politicians.
Those same politicians. You've got sort of folks sitting on opposite sides of the table who nonetheless, one's a campaign supporter of the other. So it ends up, you create this sort of circle,
right.
There. So that ends up being a significant concern. And I think, quite frankly, it's a concern of some of the workers as well. You've got the folks like Rebecca Friedrichs out there who says, wait, no, that's not how I want the system to work. That's not how I want to speak. That's not how I want my funds to be used. But they don't have an effective mechanism for raising those objections.
Well, shouldn't.
Thankfully, worker voting rights, through this, there's a provision in federal law which allows the states to provide a remedy for this, and states are starting to take it up.
Oh,
yeah, because I think they should be prohibited from contributing to political campaigns if they're a public sector union. I mean, because you're exactly right. Those people that they're supporting are the same people.
We're dealing with this
to.
In our city council,
yeah,
right now.
It's a vicious circle, and
they keep giving the union increases and all that, and now we're having a big pension
the union
crisis.
Keeps voting them, keeps giving them money to be elected. It's wrong.
Well, and you look at something like the pension crisis, for instance. Oftentimes, unfortunately, you've got this system in which they end up voting for more. Pushing for more and more generous pension packages, ones that don't necessarily track how it is that we've done pension reform in the private sector. I mean, at this point, it's extraordinarily rare in the private sector to find a defined benefit pension system. You may find one, but it's the exception and not the rule. This is the idea that, you're going to get a fixed pension after vesting. And it doesn't sort of matter. It's not about how much you put in, you get out a fixed amount. It's very rare that you see that sort of guarantee anymore. Generally speaking, what they do is they've gone to something like a 401k system, a defined contribution system, where you put in so much, perhaps your employer matches at a certain level, and that helps it depends how the market does and so forth, but you're given a pension that way. By contrast, in the public sector, we still see, many of these municipalities, states, et cetera, clinging to these defined benefit systems, and they are drowning. They are drowning in debt, trying to keep up with it. The taxpayers are on the hook to meet the difference, and it ends up squeezing out. The interesting thing is it ends up hurting workers at the end of the day. It ends up squeezing out the ability to hire more employees because, the pension obligations are so high that prevents them. So you've got, it's in some places they're understaffed. It threatens the actual ability for the jurisdiction to be able to pay out on those pension obligations, risking whether or not the individuals will actually get the money that they've worked so hard for. And so switching to a system that would actually be provide for solvency and for long-term stability would actually allow the municipalities to better manage, to hire more workers, to make sure that those obligations are paid. But you see, and you frequently see, the unions fighting tooth and nail. And again, it's not clear if those questions were fairly presented, whether or not that would be the view of the workers.
Sure.
But, if in fact it's like, okay, you can have this system, but it's not clear whether or not we're going to be able to pay on this. We're drowning in red ink. And by the way, it's going to make it so that we can't hire more policemen or more firefighters because we just can't afford it. Many
sure.
People
and if the city goes
that's
broke,
not, that's not the way.
Yeah. If the city goes broke, I mean, I think it's Loyalton that people are getting paid. I think it's 40 cents on the dollar for their pension, and they're already retired, so they've passed the point where they can actually adjust for that, and they ran it up,
yeah,
and
lost 60% of their retirement,
blew the place up. We've got to take a really quick break, and we'll be back with our guest Robert Ault. He is the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute, and today we're chatting about workers' voting rights. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us. Songs with the word union in it. I did not know that. Okay, so Robert, we kind of extended the break so we could run you right up to the top of the hour without interrupting again. But, all right, we have more questions than we have answers over here.
We're confused.
Okay, so we're like, well, wait a minute, how does that work? Okay, so we're still spinning with the idea that if you are in a teachers union, you could actually pick a different union to represent the teachers in that school.
That's right.
Yeah, we're still processing that.
Now.
Well, not now because there's no election. But let's just say you were in a place that allowed you to choose. I mean, can teacher, see, I always thought that teachers were in the teachers union and there was only one. And I figured, okay, if you're in California, you're in a California teachers union that's part of the big union. I don't know. I kind of thought it was like a food. Yeah, like I thought it was a big national union. It was like a food chain and you were just in your regional area.
Your little sector.
But okay, so if you're a teacher and you got to choose, you could actually be represented by Teamsters?
Well, and it depends upon whether that union represents those voting block or those particular units. But there's
sure.
At least two big teachers unions. You've got the American Federation of Teachers, and they've got local affiliates, and you've got the National Education Association, and they've got state and local affiliates. But you know, I gave the example from you're a bus driver. You know, in some cases, those are represented by the teachers union. In some cases, they're represented by groups like the Teamsters. And the other thing is, of course, we're acting like this is static, like you couldn't have a new union form.
Either. Right, right.
You know, let's say you know, once again, this is the whole question with regard to the cable companies I mentioned. When there was only one company, you didn't have choice. But interestingly enough, once competition got opened up a bit, you saw a bunch of players getting into that space. Right now, why would you start up a new union to represent teachers, for instance, when, if there is a teachers union in place, it's almost impossible for them to change, who's representing them. But if those same teachers unions had to stand for regular reelection, there might be an incentive for you to go ahead and say, you know what, we could actually offer you better services for a cheaper price. We could,
kidding.
We would actually use your money for X. You could have them campaigning against each other to represent those workers. Would really, again, the idea behind this is to empower the workers and put them in the driver's seat.
It's just madness.
And
how
the
exciting.
Key to this, the key to this as well is it genuinely operates in that way. In the states where you've seen it operate, in some cases, the workers are very satisfied with their unions, and they vote them back in. That happened in Iowa recently, where they had worker voting rights elections for public sector unions. There was very high voter participation rates, I think something like 88%, and it was something in the ballpark, I think of 86% or so of the unions statewide were voted back in, were recertified. You've had other situations where a number of unions would get voted out because the workers were not satisfied. Nothing dictates how it is that the workers vote. What this does, though, is it provides something that's been sorely missing for a long time. It provides them with the opportunity to vote.
Sure.
And to actually have a voice, finally, after oftentimes decades without a vote.
How do they become a place that gets to vote? How did those people get to vote and other people don't?
It requires a change either in state or federal law. So the states can go ahead and pass a requirement that public sector unions or some section of them or all of them would have to stand for regular reelection. And they can choose how frequently that occurs. In some states it's every year. In one state, Tennessee, that I'm familiar with, they run the elections every 3 years.
Now these are elections. These are elections to decide which union represents them. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, not the people in the union.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
it's a question of whether or not they wish to continue being represented by the union that's currently represented.
Okay, and then within that union, you also have elections for like the president and the officers of the union. And now, do most unions have those elections as well? Or
most unions do have elections for their leadership, but in terms of that, frequently I feel like from what I've heard that unions don't necessarily feel like they have a great deal of say or like the leadership elections really have as much of an impact on the direction of the unions. Whereas again, doing something like this where you get to choose whether or not you're wishing to keep that union as your representative really provides a much greater level of accountability and voice.
That's interesting because I would think that the leadership of a union would have a big impact on the direction of you know, progress within the union. But you're saying that doesn't necessarily the case.
Oftentimes, again, the complaint that I've tended to hear is that they feel like, you know, when it by the time it comes time to pick whoever the union leadership is, the slate, you know, that you're given limited options,
right,
in terms of who it is that's going to actually be a representative, and so it feels like you don't have as much of a voice in terms of those elections.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a situation like this, where they've actually have to fight, they have to fight to keep your business. You know, in those elections, again, whoever wins, the union is still going to be your representative. And so there's much less incentive for them to change the way they're doing business if you're dissatisfied.
No kidding.
That's interesting.
Well, this is a well-kept secret, actually.
it is, but it's slowly getting out there. In fact, there was a piece of legislation that was dropped in Congress just recently that would also provide for it nationwide. That said, I don't know about you. I spent a lot of time working in Washington, and I don't anymore, and for a good reason. I feel like the real action in terms of getting things done is at the state level.
Unless you live in California, in which case we pray the federal government will come and save us, which is really screwed up.
Send in the federals.
Yeah. Well, maybe the federal government could do something. We're like, oh, what is wrong with this picture? Yeah, because usually the closer to home it is, the better it works.
The bigger change you can make.
Except for here.
If we have a governor who has decided he wants to refight the Civil War.
Yeah. And hey, if you'd like to swing over, you can pay an extra dollar a gallon for gas now, which is great.
Oh, that's always nice.
Uh-huh, it's always spectacular.
Well, let me toss out, a reed of hope even for California, which is to say,
even
the
for
thing
us.
About worker voting rights is that it is wildly popular with union households. I mean, nationwide, it scores in polling between 82 and 85% popularity.
Yep. Oh, you no know, kidding.
Outstanding. Here in Ohio, it's actually 90% approval rating for worker voting rights in union households. It scores better in union households than it scores in non-union households, in polling, by multiple percentage points in every poll I've ever seen. And we've done a ton of polling, and we've oversampled union households because we want to know what union workers think on this. And the answer is they want to have that voice and choice. So even in a place like California, where, again, you've got very powerful public sector unions, the workers, the folks who they're supposed to be representing them, really want to have this right. And it's the sort of thing, I think, based upon that, the politicians, you know, should stand up and take notice of this.
Yeah. Well, I guess I've had kind of, you know, obviously it doesn't affect, it does affect all of us, in service and cost and all those things. It does eventually hit everybody. But since I'm not in a union, I had kind of figured in the back of my mind, unions were sort of headed for the scrap heap of history, just because they seem to be pretty dysfunctional, but including some competition in there. That's a mm-hmm. whole, that's a game changer. Does private sector union have that as well?
Private sector unions, at least there's not the ability of the states to weigh in the same way. Federal law allows, because of the special relationship involved with public sector workers, unions working on behalf of the state and local governments, they have the option of providing for these regular elections. For private sector employers, there's not a similar option, at least not under state law. Is my understanding. I believe that would have to be done through federal legislation.
Okay. And what about the, like, SEIU? That seems mm-hmm. to be, like, the catch-all union. I'm always surprised that somebody's in SEIU. But we've got all sorts mm-hmm. of people doing all sorts of things. Are they just another option? They could have picked something different?
Again, the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, represents a number of different public sector employees. They've tried to extend out into
everything.
A lot, I think sort of the new areas they've grown into are things like home health care, or childcare and the like. But again, if you happen to be represented by them, this sort of system would allow you to choose to see whether or not you feel like you're getting good services or not from the SEIU. And if you're not, you could choose to either reject the representation or see if there's another union that might be able to provide the services for you.
So you could actually vote to reject their services and not be represented by a union at all?
Well,
that's correct.
Yeah.
Well,
under this system.
Under worker voting rights. In the absence of that, let's say, for instance, you were dissatisfied, you were represented by a union that was you're one of these teachers, you're in a school district where, again, the union was voted in before you were born, you're not happy with the services you're getting, you'd like to actually vote them out. The system that currently exists in order to do that is extraordinarily difficult, and it places the burden on the worker. In Ohio, again, where I'm a little bit more familiar, just use that as an example, you have to begin by collecting a number of signatures in a very short period of time to be able to hold a certification election. And just to put into perspective, in many cases, you would have to collect more signatures in order to actually, have this election than you would have to collect if, let's say you wanted to become the governor of the state of Ohio. You have this enormous number of signatures to gather. I think you've got about 2 weeks in order to do it.
Oh, wow.
It's very difficult. And then you have to have the election. It does happen on occasion, and it has happened, but it is really quite difficult. And that's just not generally speaking how we do things in this country. We don't say, we're going to have one election, we're going to bind you in to being represented by, a particular group. We're going to require you to pay fees or dues to that organization. And it's going to go on for not just for your lifetime, but for decades to come. And if you ever want to change it, we're going to make it extraordinarily difficult for you to do that. That's just not fair. It denies a legitimate voice to these workers. Having these regular elections, as we've seen it, in some cases the unions win, as they did in Iowa. In some cases they don't. But in all cases, the workers actually are the ones who decide, and they get the voice and the choice with regard to their representation.
That's great. So if you had a chunk of people in the union and they were thinking, we didn't really, they're not maybe high enough up on the totem pole to really understand the big workings of the whole thing, but they're thinking, our union's crummy, and they're, they're doing a kind of a bad job. They live in a state like this where workers' voting rights are not allowed or mandated, or I'm not sure which way you look at it. What do they do at this point? They have to change the law for the whole state, or can they collect enough people to toss their union out? How do they do that?
Yeah, how does that work?
Once again, they've got a couple of options. They could try and decertify their union, and they could see how it, once again, it is possible. It's difficult, but it is possible.
Yeah.
But additionally, they could look to change the law in the state. And if they're interested in doing that and learning, what worker voting rights, how it works and how it might work for them, first thing I would say to do is to go to our website, workervotingrights.org. We've got information about the law on it. We've got information about how it works. We've got white papers and videos and a ton of resources to help you out. And then additionally, if you need more information after looking at that, I'd say please contact us, contact the Buckeye Institute. We'd be happy to chat with you all about how worker voting rights works and how it could work for your state.
That's awesome. Mm. Well, we'll post all that for people for a resource, because I'm just guessing, but I think a lot of people are just, drilling along under the system that they're on, trying to maybe not have to pay dues to the rotten union if they're rotten, and they figure that they're kind of trapped. So, kind of nice to have choices, even in California.
Choice is good.
Yeah, choice is always better.
Even in California. And we did see, I think all of us, and who've been around a while and paid cable bills, that's a really good example because it did used to be.
Oh yeah, there was one game in town, and you had that or a big antenna on your roof, and that was it. You paid one company.
Well, we see it with the power companies now. I mean, you choose, you know, around here anyway, you choose your housing because it's so hot here in the summer. You choose your housing based on who controls your power because you picked the wrong place, mm-hmm. and you got an $800 bill every month.
You got two rents to pay.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome. Yeah, living here is expensive. And that makes it kind of silly. But, we'd like to have everybody'd like to have some choices, I think. This has been really interesting. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the information. And we will definitely send people workervotingrights.org. And I don't know. I think they should contact the Buckeye Institute and find out how to help themselves, because there are a lot of people out there, I think, who could really benefit. I think it would help our public sector services, too. If people weren't so frustrated on the job or, you know, weren't being led around by the nose, I think they might get more done. So, as a taxpayer, I'd be a big fan.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on. We do appreciate it. Great information.
Thanks for spending your Sunday afternoon with us. I hope people do go to the website and pull up some of those links and check out more that Robert Ault and the Buckeye Institute can do for you. Thanks, Robert, for coming on.
Thank you, Robert.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. And Bob is playing some sort of song that requires explanation.
Oh, you will remember it.
International Ladies, what?
Garment Workers Union, one of the most popular commercials of the 70s.
That's right. The union label.
Get out more. I missed that.